I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Tristan Walker, founder of Walker & Company Brands, which makes beauty and health products for people of color. Prior to starting Walker & Company, Tristan was the first African-American entrepreneur in residence at the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. He was formerly the director of business development at the location-based check-in app Foursquare, and also had an internship stint at Twitter. He was a trader on Wall Street at Lehman Brothers and J.P. Morgan for a couple of years before the crash in 2008. He is also the founder of Code 2040, a program that connects Black and Latino coders with Silicon Valley startups for summer internships. Tristan is a graduate of Hotchkiss High School, Stony Brook University, and Stanford Business School. He is originally from Queens, New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jessica.
So before we get started on your past, I just want to know, what are the unique needs of people of color? And when we say people of color, by the way, are we talking about Blacks, Latinos, Asians, or just...
Absolutely right. Black, Latino, Asian consumers, the majority of the world. Funny enough, we're tackling what we believe to be a very significant opportunity. When we think about people of color, there are a kind of multitude of problems that have gone unsolved. You think about things like shaving irritation, right? A problem that up to 80% of Black men and women have and 30% of everyone else. We think about things related to hyperpigmentation, even things as profound as the prevalence of miscarriage in the community. There are just really profound issues in the health and beauty space for folks of color that have gone unsolved, and we want to solve those problems.
Why does a regular razor blade cause bumps or irritation on the skin?
So a lot of folks of color, like myself, I have curly hair. And I can't use a lot of the multi-blade razors that exist out in the market today because they cut the hair beneath my skin. And if I have curly hair, what's that going to do? Just grow right back into my skin, causing issues related to razor bumps, ingrown hairs, etc. It saps my confidence, among other things.
And when did it occur to you finally to say, you know what, I want to address this?
Yeah, so when I really first realized how much issues related to shaving irritation sapped my confidence was my first internship on Wall Street, actually. It was a trading floor internship. I'll never forget this moment. There's a gentleman, a trader, who stood up, looked at me in the face, and he said, "Young man, take that crap off of your face," right? In front of all the other interns. And I felt, wow, no, number one, yes, you're a jerk. But outside of that, I remember being mortified by the fact that I couldn't even think of which products I could use to help fix the condition without exacerbating it.
And by crap, what did he mean?
Hair on my face.
I see.
Right?
You mentioned miscarriages. What does miscarriages have to do with it?
Women of color actually miscarry at a much higher rate than women who are not women of color. My wife, back in December of 2013, actually had a miscarriage, and it was one of the hardest things that we ever had to deal with. And in doing the research, I started to understand that I think some 20% of all pregnancies in a miscarriage. But for women of color, that percentage is way higher. And there's very limited research to suggest why. But recently, there's some compelling research that can draw a straight line between the types of chemical relaxers women put in their hair and the prevalence of uterine fibroids, right, which leads to potential infertility and miscarriage. This is a problem, right? And I think, companies just really need to be thoughtful about every person's physiological makeup and deliver a suite of products that can be incredibly efficacious and suit their needs in the right way.
You know, we talk about these incumbent companies kind of not being well educated in understanding the Black and the people of color market. Mm-hmm. It was also the case really with your investors. When you were looking for venture capital, it was not as, obvious to your investors. Can you talk about some stories and issues that you encountered on that
Absolutely.
Front?
Absolutely. I'll give you one that just illuminates this point. It's my very first pitch. I remember I was on like slide 14, and I had the Bevel shaving system next to the Proactive acne system. The point that I was trying to make was you really can't think about Bevel as like Bevel versus multi-blade razors, much in the same way that you can't think about Proactive versus Neutrogena, right? For Proactive, you can go spend $30 a month for the system to help eliminate the acne issue, or you can go pay $7 for a Neutrogena bottle. So we take that system approach. And I'll never forget this moment. She looked at me and she said, "Tristan, I'm not sure issues related to shaving irritation, razor bumps, et cetera, have as big a societal impact in your solving it as issues related to acne. At which point I thought, I understand why you might be saying it, but all you had to do after the meeting was get on the phone with 10 black men. 9 of them would have said that this is a terrible issue that we have to deal with. So the thing that I think was incredibly disappointing, and we still get this today, is a lot of investors' lack of willingness to acquire the context to understand what we're doing. And, you know, what I learned in that experience is that it had nothing to do with a perceived belief that my idea was bad. It was just the laziness in their willingness to acquire that context.
What other examples are there of just people saying, well, I don't think it's a big enough market or...
Yeah. I mean, well, we still get that today. I mean, I can't tell you how many journalists talk about how we're tackling a niche market. And I'm like, well, it's the majority of the world. You can consider that as niche as you want to. And that's great. We don't believe that to be the case.
Who were some of the investors who really helped to give you credibility, whether it was on the institutional front or individuals?
So one of my largest investors, Andreessen Horowitz. They've been a part of pretty much every startup that I've been a part of, Twitter, Foursquare, and now Walker & Company. You have folks like Nas, the hip-hop artist. He was my first investor.
How did you and Nas connect, for example?
Yeah, well, first of all, Queens. Nas from Queens as well has a strong relationship with Andreessen Horowitz. And it was an interesting pitch. You know, after 2 minutes, he got it. And what's interesting, you know, we have quite a few celebrities who are investors in the company. It's less a function of, you know, they're being investors because they just want to get on the hot kind of technology investment thing, and more the fact that they walk down the same aisles I do.
You're talking about Magic Johnson.
Magic Johnson, John Legend, Nas, Harrison Barnes, Andre Iguodala. You know, they're walking down those aisles. They understand that they're still getting treated like second-class citizens.
When you were launching the product, what do you think was most effective in getting people to buy a $60 starter kit and a monthly of $30 for your service?
Yeah, so the thing that I think is interesting to understand about our first brand, Bevel, is that it's solving a problem that's been around for 100 years and nobody solved. So you got to really understand this experience, this moment of truth where you shave with Bevel, you wake up the following morning and you didn't break out. Like, that is a moment. And that is a moment that folks are willing to share. And also, I think, a really big testament to why over 98% of our customers buy from us every month.
How did you get those customers initially?
70-80% of our customers come through organically via word of mouth. It only took a few supporters to get us all the supporters that we have currently.
Like
people
who?
Talk.
Like who were
no,
some
just,
of those
just
supporters?
Just your ordinary customers, right? We have, you know, the single mom who's teaching her son how to shave, right? That's an important story. That's a story that's my story. I didn't have a father to teach me to shave. The gentleman in the army, you know, you got to shave every day. And I'll never forget this moment. The gentleman said, Tristan, for as long as I can remember, issues related to razor bumps have been as big a part of my military career as my uniform.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tristan Walker, founder of Walker Company Brands. Walker makes products that tailor to the unique needs of people of color. Tristan launched the company in 2013 after serving as an entrepreneur in residence at the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. You are from Queens, New York.
I am.
And I must say, so am I.
Yes.
And I want to talk about your background.
Absolutely.
Your mother is Betty.
Yes.
What was she like? What is she like?
Yeah, my mom is you know, one of the greatest women I know. And she taught me really the virtue of hard work. You know, there's a woman who had to raise 3 children by herself, working 2 to 3 jobs at a time.
Now, those 2 to 3 jobs, she was working for the New York Housing Authority
in
the
day.
Time Warner Cable.
You know, just a lot of administrative type work. And I'm truly indebted to her and what she's done to us in support of me.
Now, your dad died when you were 4.
I was 4 years old.
How did he die?
He was killed. And to this day, you know, I haven't even asked my mom how. I still have these lingering kind of memories of him and how much I loved him, et cetera. And I never wanted to taint that image. You know, you don't want to kind of get that full story because you almost can inevitably guess where that leads. And I just never wanted to taint that picture of him.
Are you getting closer to wanting to know?
Yeah, I will. I most likely will want to know, particularly now that I have my own son. Yeah.
You had a brother named Sean who was 14 years older than you, and it seemed like he was a pretty prominent part of your upbringing.
Yeah, no, I mean, in a world where I didn't really have a father to raise me, Sean took that place for me.
Your mom, because she worked late hours, she enrolled you at the Boys Club of New York, which is basically like an after-school program?
Yeah, 75 cents. Changed my life. Absolutely. Yeah, I'd go to the Boys Club of New York, play for their basketball team, you know, you have ping pong, pool, all that jazz.
Is it 75 cents a day or something?
It was 75 cents a year when I was growing up. Yeah, it was crazy. And I like to say it was the greatest ROI investment my mom has ever made. You know, through the Boys Club of New York, you know, I was able to, you know, get a full ride to the Hotchkiss School.
Right, because there happened to be this one coach who said, I hear you're a straight A student and a great basketball player. Why don't you take the SSATs and apply to prep schools?
And what do you know? I got in. You know, I got into a school out in Santa Barbara, and then I got into Hotchkiss.
What was this guy's name?
His name was Anthony Blake. Anthony was in my wedding. He's still a mentor of mine. I am very thankful for everything that he has done for me. He changed my life.
So you end up at Hotchkiss, which is in Lakeville, Connecticut. Tell me about the differences you saw.
You know, I like to describe it as, you know, finally observing how the other half lived, right? You know, I got to go to school with Rockefellers and Fords, and it was my first view into what wealth was. I really didn't have any experience with that other than what I saw on television. And I knew right away I was ill-prepared for it. I didn't know what a verb was when I was a freshman there. And then it only took me a short period of time to realize I can compete with them just as well as I can compete with anyone else.
When you said that you saw what wealth was, what was your emotional reaction? Was it like, wow, this is amazing, I want to be a part of it? Or was it like, this isn't fair? Like, what was the emotional spectrum of things?
I thought immediately I wanted to be a part of this. You know, much in the same way that I, you know, went to school with the Rockefellers and Fords, I wanted my last name to mean something. I had one goal in life at the time, and that was to get as wealthy as possible, as quickly as possible. I realized that there are only a couple ways to do it. Stony Brook, you know, I graduated 3 years, and, you know, fortunately, top of the class, and had the opportunity to get a front office role. And look, I mean, I had every ambition to be a Wall Street trader and retire young, make all this money.
And make your mom proud.
Exactly, only to realize I hated it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tristan Walker, founder of Walker & Company. We'll hear more coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Tristan Walker, founder of Walker & Company Brands, which makes beauty and health products for people of color. So you got to Wall Street. You hated it from, like, day one?
As a full-time employee, I hated it day one.
Yet you continue doing it because you thought it was your way out.
Yeah, it was a good job, paid good money.
What other jobs did you have growing up?
Oh, man. Clean toilets. That was my first job at a summer camp in New Jersey, at the Boys Club in New York, actually. When I was 15, maybe 16, I was a camp counselor the following summer. And then during university, I started my first internship at Lehman Brothers in the back office operations in Jersey City. Mm-hmm. And halfway through that summer, I found my way into the front office in New York. And then I just had trading internships ever since.
And the crash of 2008 kind of saved you. Because, well, you tell me, but is that one of the reasons why you decided to go to business school, Stanford?
Yeah, so what was interesting, so I left J.P. Morgan in January of 2008. Actually, I didn't leave. I got fired, right? And this was before the recession hit. I believe it was like September, October of that year.
Why did you get fired?
Well, at the time, my manager, and I only had one manager, and I was his only report, about 4 or 5 months prior, he was let go. So I was just meandering around, kind of looking for that mentorship, and they couldn't provide it at the time. And I remember it being so devastating because it was about a week or two before I was hearing back from Stanford. I hadn't received a bonus at all. My wife and I had just bought an apartment in Queens and were renovating it, right? So there was kind of 1 to 2 weeks of extreme anxiety and angst. And fortunately, I was able to get into Stanford. I was able to get my bonus and everything all worked out.
Do you remember receiving word from Stanford?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. And I'll never forget, it was early morning. You know, it's Derek Bolton, who's the head of admissions, and, you know, he calls every student that gets admitted personally. And, you know, he gets on the phone, and I wasn't expecting this at all. And I'm thinking, I'm having a conversation for about a minute, minute and a half with him as if he were the J.P. Morgan managing director, right? And I'm like, oh, what's going to happen? Like, am I going to get the bonus or not? And a minute and a half in, Derek Bolton's like, Tristan, you do know this is Derek, right? And at that moment, I let out a huge scream, sigh of relief, and just appreciated the blessing at that moment.
Did you know that people who are accepted get calls?
I knew it was a thing. I didn't know when it would happen. Mm-hmm. So it happened at around like 7, 8 in the morning, mm-hmm. and they're based on the West Coast, so there's no way that I would have thought he would have been awake around 3, 4 in the morning.
Did you also apply to other MBA programs?
That was the only program I applied to. I tend to be fairly kind of like, you know, one-track mind when I'm really focused like that. And at the time, I said, you know, Stanford's about this entrepreneurship thing. It's interesting to me. And also, I want to get as far away, literally and figuratively, as possible from Wall Street.
So you were married at the time to Amoy.
Yes.
How old were you when you got married?
I was 23 years old.
How do you know her?
So she and I went to university together. My last semester at university, I was studying abroad in London. And she and I had kind of a lot of mutual friends, just never met each other during my entire time at Stony Brook. And I'll never forget, she, when I was in London, Facebook had like that poke feature, like she had poked me. And that really like started our friendship. And became best friends very quickly through our own mutual connections. And when I got back, we became even closer friends. A month later, we were dating. And a year later, we were engaged.
What does she do?
She's a teacher, seventh grade humanities out in Palo Alto now.
So you and Amoy make your way to Stanford Business School.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's, you know, for me, I knew that that was the place I wanted to live, Palo Alto, Bay Area. There was an energy and a richness in this whole innovation economy that got me excited.
And you were learning about this richness and innovation just through your reading because you had never been to the West Coast.
Well, I didn't, not even through my reading. I mean, I thought Silicon Valley was a place where semiconductors got made. It wasn't until I got out for in August of 2008, I saw other 24-year-olds not only making millions of dollars, but fundamentally changing the world. And I said, how did I not know about this place? That's a problem. And I did everything that I could to kind of really ingrain myself in the culture there.
You landed an internship at Twitter for the summer.
So my first year in business school, we had just started a new curriculum at Stanford, actually. And in your first quarter, you are not allowed to like work anywhere. You got to focus on your studies. They kind of stack rank all of the most of the core curriculum in the first year. I'm a bit stubborn, and I decided to work full-time anyway. So that fall into spring, I worked full-time as an intern at Twitter as well.
What was that like?
It was amazing. I mean, it was a time when there were only 20 people at the company.
Is how you got the job interesting?
So in order to get that job, you know, that starts to become like an access thing. So I said, in order to get here, I'm going to have to figure out, you know, who's 1 degree separated from these folks. I reached out to 20 different folks. The last person, the gentleman, David Hornick, he's a partner at August Capital, but also a professor at Stanford. I reached out to him and asked him, like, what would it take to get that internship? He asked me two questions. He said, number one, Tristan, do you have ideas for the company? I said, sure, I do. I have ideas for everything. And then two, are you willing to work for free? And I said, yes. And he's like, all right, give me a resume. 2 days later, I got an email from folks over at Twitter calling me in for an interview. And the following week, I had an internship.
Now, how you got your first full-time job at Foursquare is also kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How did that happen?
So same way as Twitter, in so much as Foursquare is really changing my life. It was the only thing that would get me out of bed to go to the gym more, right? And there was something in that that was really interesting.
What do you mean?
Yeah, so at Foursquare, we would kind of offer up these incentives to get folks to do things, to explore their cities a little bit more differently. So we had this thing called the Gym Rat Badge. If you check in at a gym more than 10 times, you unlock this badge. And, you know, I'd be 4 check-ins away, and I'd wake up on a rainy day and go to the gym just so I can get it. around that time, I emailed the founders. I found their emails on the internet. Dennis and Naveen. Yeah. Emailed them 8 times. The 8th time, Dennis replied back. He said verbatim, "You know what? I just may take you up on some of this. Are you ever in New York? Dens." I was in LA at the time, and I remember looking at my wife and saying, "Hey, what should I do?" Like, this guy, after 8 emails, finally got back to me. A couple minutes later, I replied back. I said, "Actually, you know what? I was planning on being in New York tomorrow. I booked my flight that night, flew out the following day, hung out with him for a week, and a month later, I was running business development for the company."
So you booked your flight specifically for him after the
fact. Specifically for that. And it was so crazy. You can ask him to this day. I walked up. We were at 36 Cooper Square. We were on the 5th floor. And I walk in, and it was just Dennis and Naveen and Harry, lead engineer at the time. And Dennis turned around and looked at me completely surprised because he didn't think I was going to come. And I just like walked over to an empty seat, sat down, and got to work.
You mentioned flying back to New York and yeah. flying to Palo Alto. Yeah. Just before we started recording, you mentioned that you were on the red eye from San Francisco yeah. this morning and that you are scared of flying.
It's biggest fear in the world.
When did
as much as I travel, it sucks.
Do you remember your first flight? How old
yeah,
were you?
Yeah, so I used to like flying a lot, actually. And it wasn't until I actually got to business school that I started hating it. Mm-hmm. And there were two flights in particular that really completely changed. And one was flying from New York to Los Angeles. And when you fly in, you see buildings on each side as you approach the runway. And once you see those buildings, the plane looks like it's going faster. And it just terrified me. And then the second time, it was my birthday in 2009. And I remember this so vividly because it was the first time I bought myself noise-canceling headphones. And it was Beats by Dre. And my wife and I were flying from LA to Seattle. And it was the first time I actually experienced an airplane like dropping in the sky for a few seconds. And I was so terrified listening to music on my noise-canceling headphones. I let out the biggest scream, but I couldn't hear it because I had the noise-canceling headphones. And I grabbed my wife's leg so tight, and she had like these marks on it. And I was like, oh, I feel so bad. But I really knew I messed up because not only was she laughing at me, everyone else on the plane was laughing at me, but I was terrified. Yeah. And still to this day, those two flights have completely kind of changed me, and I travel quite a bit.
It's striking to me the intensity of your fear, even though it doesn't keep yeah. you from flying, because yeah. it seems like you're afraid of very little.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's one thing that I can't control, mm-hmm. and that scares me to no end.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tristan Walker, founder of Walker & Company Brands, a company that makes products tailored to the unique needs of the Black and Latino population. What were some other ideas that you had that you were flirting with before starting this specific company? Because you had a bunch of them.
You know, I spent 9 months at Andreessen Horowitz thinking about, the most ambitious thing that I could build. I wanted to build a bank for underserved communities, the unbanked, underbanked. I wanted to fix trucking in the country and freight. I thought about an idea to fix childhood obesity, only to realize in those first 7 months that I wasn't going to be the best person in the world to solve those problems. Mm-hmm. And one bit of advice I'd get from Ben Horowitz is, Tristan, like, what is the thing that you fundamentally feel that you'd be the best person in the world to solve?
Do you remember, like, the day you were like, oh, I have an idea?
Oh, absolutely. for about 14 years prior to my starting Pebble, I couldn't use multi-blade razors, and, you know, electric trimmers weren't that great for me. And I used depilatory cream.
What's that?
So, like, Nair, right? Like, I didn't use the Nair itself, but, like, it's the type of depilatory cream. You let it sit on your face for 6 to 8 minutes. You don't need a razor. You wipe it off, and your hair is gone. Now, just the thought about that is pretty crazy, right? Like, how is it even possible? Because a lot of those products contain hazardous harsh chemicals that can burn your skin. It smells terribly, among other things. And, you know, I had my last kind of purchase of those things, and I just got incredibly frustrated. And I started to ask the question, why hasn't this problem been solved for folks? And I remember speaking to an old retired consumer packaged goods executive and asked him that same question. And he said something a bit facetiously, and he said, Tristan, go look at photos of Black men 100, 150 years ago. None of them had razor bumps on their faces, right? And I thought, I was like, let me look into this. And I remember going to Flickr, and entering generic search terms like black men in the 1920s, Harlem Renaissance sites, I went through 1,200 photos. I did not find one photo of a black man with laser bumps on his face. And at that point, I said, wow, there's something going on here. Why is this the case? They all shave. They're all cleanly shaven, right? But we can't use multi-blade razors, and they didn't exist back then. So what do they use? And that sent me down this path of really understanding, you know, developing a way that everyone used to shave, which is, in our opinion, the best way to shave.
Isn't it interesting? Like, yeah. You're basically going back to the basics, yeah. Which is just a single razor.
And that's it.
Blade
it's
razor.
As simple as that. And you know, the way I think about it right now is in 20, 30 years, there's going to be a lot more curly-haired folks in this country. What are they going to be using?
You are also the founder of Code 2040, which is a nonprofit. It's an organization that helps people of color get internships at Silicon Valley startups.
Yeah.
And you work with Laura Wideman Powers, mm-hmm. who's the CEO. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So first, Laura was a classmate of mine in business school. And she's one of the most impressive folks that I know. And Code 2040 was really founded to ensure that more folks don't make the same mistake I did.
And which
that's
was?
Realizing that Silicon Valley exists too late. I realized it when I was 24. Had I realized the potential in Silicon Valley when I was 14, 16, 18, perhaps my career trajectory would be markedly different right now.
Why is it called 2040?
Because in 2040, that's when the majority-minority flip happens, where folks of color start to become the majority of this country.
I want to talk about like what the current state of the world, the yeah. Silicon Valley world is.
Sure.
So Google has close to 50,000 employees. 1% of the technology workers is black. Same at Facebook, 1%. And by the way, right now, blacks are 13 to 15% of
yeah,
the population.
That's right.
Why is this number so low?
So there's, I think there's a couple ways to kind of unpack that question. I think first, there's still implicit bias in the interview process. You know, our Code 2040 fellows, we have a 90%+ full-time offer rate. These are stellar engineers. I remember like one of our first few summers, we would have fellows go and interview for full-time positions. And a lot of them weren't getting offers from a lot of the larger technology companies. And we started to wonder why. And we started to realize that a lot of those fellows were suffering in the interview process with the whiteboard interviews. So you know, you're asked a kind of engineering kind of problem or a logic kind of question. You have to go to the whiteboard and kind of write out your thinking around how you'd answer it. None of these kids were exposed to that kind of interviewing. So at Code 2040, we try and think about things that can help kind of mitigate that implicit bias, not only for companies, but also to help students get around that as well.
I want to talk about Queens.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
How did it influence you? What's special yeah. about Queens?
Yeah, I think it's also important to really understand kind of where I grew up in Queens, right?
Yeah.
So I was born in South Jamaica, Queens, 40 Projects. When I was 6 years old, moved to Flushing, Queens, Latimer Projects.
Who's Latimer?
Louis Latimer. So he helped Thomas Edison with the filament of the light bulb and one of the kind of earliest like black scientists. Really, really stellar man. So a lot of my upbringing was in the projects, right? I think that's important context as well, right? It taught me a lot about grit, resilience, you know, how important it was to do good, taught me the importance of loyalty, courage, right?
What are some examples? Like we're, you know, all these big words, but like bring it down from 10,000 feet, what life was like daily without,
yeah.
with a mom who's at working at Time Warner Cable.
Yeah,
and
yeah. I mean, I know what it's like to take a food stamp and buy your food at the store, right? I know what it's like at 8:30 at night in your bed on the 10th floor hearing gunshots outside of your home, right? You know, I know what it's like not being allowed to go across the street to the park out of fear that something would happen, right? You know, that's a life that I had to grow up in and still kind of excel in. And if anything, Queens, probably more than any other place I've ever lived, really taught me this value of, you know, being not only diligent, but just working harder than anyone else.
I think you tweeted this.
Tweets. Uh-oh.
Yeah. You're famous for your tweets.
Oh,
is that right?
Man. Or infamous.
Yeah. One of them I like was trials you go through.
Yes.
And the blessings you receive are the exact same thing.
Yeah. It's the best advice I've ever gotten. Tyler Perry, writer, producer, actor, gave me that advice. Tyler Perry is a fascinating entrepreneur. You know, he was homeless for some period of his life. Now he's one of the highest paid folks in Hollywood. And what he meant by that is those trials are just lessons, right? And there are blessings in those lessons.
What might I not know about you?
Oh, interesting. I'm a bit of an open book. I'm all on Twitter.
Are you really?
I am.
I don't know.
I am. I'm always willing to answer any question pretty straight with folks. What might you not know about me? I don't know. It's probably going to be the most least interesting part of your interview.
How would Amoy, your wife, answer that?
Here's probably one way she'd answer it. A lot of people think that I'm probably the most like social extroverted person out there. I'm an incredible introvert.
What do you mean by that?
I get all of my energy and just like sometimes just being alone and doing work myself or just hanging out with my wife. All that I like is spending time with my wife and my son watching reality television after a long day at work. Like, I love that stuff, right?
What is Betty doing now?
She's retired now.
Your mom?
Yeah, she's retired now.
She's still in Queens, and she's not living in the Latimer Project anymore.
She still is. Yeah. And I'm, this is why, we go back earlier in an interview, this whole aspiration around, like, wealth and that sort of thing. Like, why? One of the best lessons that, I had learned about this, I had a gentleman who said, Tristan, you want to think about spending your first third of your life learning, the second third of your life earning, and the last third returning. And he said, all too often, a lot of people try and put the return thing before the earn thing, which prevents them from scaling their impact. So the way I kind of think about my life right now is how can I shorten the earn thing so I can maximize the return? And that's not only with like Code 2040, but it's setting my mom up and giving her everything that she like deserves, right?
Yeah.
And I wish and I have every desire in the world to do that. And that is one of my just, man, like it's hard for me to just like really articulate, but it drives me every single day to do. And my family is deserving of all that.
You mean you want her to have a home outside of the Latimer?
Oh, she's, yeah, I want to get her out. And I will get her out by any means necessary. I'm on a mission there.
Thanks very much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
My guest has been Tristan Walker, founder of Walker & Company Brands. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.